Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Talking Twilight Zone.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Yes, indeed. My name is Lynn, and here we all are once again for another Twilight Zone discussion. Well, almost all of us are here again. I am joined by my co-hosts, Bobby Neer, Ken, and Robert. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
And Kelly, however, is not with us today because she has decided to leave the show and move on to other things. But we all thank her for her contributions to Talking Twilight Zone, and we all wish her the best of everything for the future. So, now today's episode up for discussion is the first episode of Season 2 and number 37 out of 156 episodes. It's called King Nine Will Not Return, and I'll now turn it over to Robert for his opening clip.
And now, Mr. Serling.
This is 1943. War spits out its violence overhead, and the sandy graveyard swallows it up. Her name is King Nine, B-25 medium bomber, 12th Air Force. On a hot, still morning, she took off from Tunisia to bomb the southern tip of Italy. An errant piece of flak tore a hole in a wing tank, and like a wounded bird, this is where she landed. Not to return on this day or any other day.
Thank you, Robert. And as I said, this is the first episode of Season 2, and it's number 37 out of the 156 Twilight Zone episodes. And before I begin, just once again, I'd like to welcome guest number 4, and I'd like to welcome Rick Wall, Rick's here again, and Jay Huddle, and Dave, of course. Okay, well, King Nine Will Not Return starred Bob Cummings as an officer who awakens in the desert in 1943, to see that his plane has gone down and his crew is missing. So he spends a good part of the episode talking to himself and calling out for his missing crew and hallucinating that he sees them. He even comes upon a makeshift grave for one of his crew members named Klein, and he apologizes to Klein for what has happened. He then goes back to the plane and he tries to radio for help, but the radio doesn't work. He goes back outside and suddenly some jet planes are zooming by in the sky overhead. Now, he knows they're jets, but he doesn't know why he knows about them, since jet planes didn't exist in 1943. So between the hallucinations of seeing his lost crew, the jets overhead, and the heat of the sun, Embry starts to lose control, and he shouts that he's dead. And then he starts yelling for help. Well, the next thing we see is Embry lying in a hospital bed. He's there because he had a nervous breakdown after seeing a newspaper headline earlier in the day that said the King Nine had been found in the desert. Well, it turns out that Embry was supposed to be on that flight, but he got cold feet and never went. The headline filled him with guilt and remorse, which caused the nervous breakdown. He tells his doctors that he was there in the desert, but then he says that maybe he dreamed it. A nurse is outside of Embry's room with his clothes when the doctors come out, and as she picks up one of his shoes, sand falls out of it. Very strange, but not strange enough for me to have liked this episode. I thought it just dragged on and was very boring. I have to admit, I've never been a Bob Cummings fan, and seeing an episode in which he was the only real character except for the last 2 or 3 minutes was tough for me to watch. The story went nowhere, and watching the guy crawl around the desert looking for a non-existent crew and having hallucinations, to me that was about as exciting as watching two flies having sex. The ending didn't shock me or even get a look of surprise from me. This one was a dud, and I have to rate it a 0 for lousy. It was a letdown for me after seeing Season 1 end with one of my favorite episodes. So I'm going to turn this over to Ken now for his reaction. Go ahead, Ken.
Okay, Lynn. The start of Season 2 started off with a dud, so sorry to say, they tried to copy the opening of season one with where is everybody? The lonely guy walking around the town. Now that episode I gave a classic because you had that strange feeling, what's coming next, nobody around, how would I react? That's how I like that episode. But this season two opener, the guy in the desert, the plane, and what does he do for the next 25 minutes? He's got hallucinations, he's hearing things in the sky, he's walking around, the sand. You see, I guess he saw somebody, but maybe he didn't. He cries a little bit, he has a joyous expression, then he's saddened. And then he says, oh, God, oh, God. And then the end of the episode, we get some sand falling out of a shoe. Sorry, Rod Serling, you tanked. I'm going to give this a zero rating because it went nowhere. And Bob Cummings in the lead role was totally miscast. Now, I like Bob Cummings in one of the movies in the 1950s. It was called Dial M for Murder. Ray Milland was in that movie, and Grace Kelly was in that movie, and he had a good role to part, so I liked him there. But you don't cast Bob Cummings in The Twilight Zone, and the reason is he's a nice guy. His face is not mean-looking at all. I mean, if you saw him in a dark alley, you would not be scared. Nobody would. You have to cast someone like Robert Mitchum. You remember that movie, Cape Fear? Oh, I would not want to get close to Robert Mitchum going after my daughter. Another one would be Robert De Niro, and he was in the movie Cape Fear, the remake.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he was a menacing figure in that movie. He was scary, especially the end scene. If you got to see Cape Fear. That was a good movie. Those two movies played out well. Another one you cast is Bela Lugosi, or Boris Karloff, or Lon Chaney. If you're going to do The Twilight Zone, and you're going to have a mysterious, strange figure, cast someone who's a little bit more frightening if you're going to have a role like this. So that's my opinion. Not much to say. The only alternative storyline I would have had... maybe have some monsters come out of the bush, or maybe have a flying saucer flying through the air. Maybe encounters of the third kind. Maybe the exorcist. Maybe have a demon somewhere. I'm trying to come up with an alternate storyline to start season two.
Agnes Moorhead coming out of the corner somewhere.
I tell you what, have a sand dune, yes, and have Agnes Moorhead show up to start the season. And have two contrast figures. Have a beautiful Elizabeth McGunry and have an old-looking Agnes Moorhead, and they just have a big sand fight in the sand dunes. I tell you what, my rating goes up to 2 or 3. But just to have Bob Cummings running around the sand dunes and falling in the sand and playing with his airplane and
he's too wimpy. Yeah. He's just too wimpy. That's the thing with him.
Yeah. Anyways, if you're going to produce a series, you're going to spend thousands of dollars on the props and maybe tens of thousands of dollars for the production and for all the scenery. You know, do a much better job. This was a second grade school project. So anyways, I'll turn it over to the next reviewer on our classes.
That's Robert.
It's Robert. Okay, Robert. Give us your honest review. Don't be nice.
Well, if you read my review, I kind of go along the same lines as you do, Ken. I don't know why they started out with the script for it. I really don't. And I just kind of wondered with season two started, how many scripts did they had to start out with? Because I would have opened with The Eye of the Beholder, which was the sixth episode of season two, or something you know, a little bit better than this one. And it's not to say that Bob Cummings is a terrible actor. It was just a terrible script. And basically it comes down to, as you said, Ken, where is everybody? Set in the desert. And he's just watching, you know, going around, going on his guilt trip and his dream. And deal with it is all I can say about it. There was nothing dramatically scary or interesting about this story. Because here again, like, it's, you know, another version of where is everybody? Maybe they thought lightning could strike twice for this season, but unfortunately it didn't. What was always interesting about this, too, was when they do Twilight Zones, they always feature one of the scenes from King Nine, Where Is Everybody, on the trailer for the opening marathon. Why? I don't know. I kind of give this one a 1 out of 5. Yeah, it is poor, but at least the effort was there. I think Cummings was just in the wrong role in this episode. It's almost like, okay, you're sitting back and your grandpa's telling the old World War II stories to you when you're a kid. I remember back in 42 when I was part of the bomber fleet and we, you know, that kind of thing. Or, yet again, this kind of looks like something that was on the cutting room floor cut from a World War II movie. We're not going to use this piece, so we'll just cut it, you know. That's pretty much what it thought, you know, felt like. As always, and if everybody's listened to season one, I usually try to find something that relates to the story. Unfortunately, there's not a lot out there to relate to this story because it being as bad. But there was something that I did come across, and it's an animation movie called Heavy Metal. And it's what it is, it's a string of stories that are bound together by this evil orb, green orb, that would cause havoc and evil in these different stories. And one was a B-17 scene. I'm going to have to describe after I play it because there again, as with anything, it's more visual, but I think you can pick up on the talk, and if you listen to it, you can hear just the evil that's in this scene. So I'll go ahead and play that to minute 35.
My powers continue.
Pretty bad, Skip.
You better go back and see how bad it is.
Okay. Can you keep her in the air, Skip?
Yeah, sure.
Skip! Something's following us!
What is it?
It's some kind of green meteorite.
What? Where?
I'm coming back.
And that was a section from Heavy Metal, which is usually runs about 7 minutes, and it's basically about the B-17 bomber flying over and being shot up. Everybody's killed in the back of the plane, except for the pilot, and I guess the assistant pilot. He goes back and check on what happens. The glove hits the plane, fills all the dead people, brings them back to life as skeletons. They force the plane. The captain's the only one left alive. He lands on the island, and then he comes to find out that the whole island is filled with these dead zombie-like creatures. So probably Canada would work out a lot better than what we got with this one. So again, my rating on this is a 1 out of 5. And I'll go ahead and pass this over to Bobby.
Oh, thank you very much, Robert. Before I get into talking about the episode itself, I want to touch briefly on something that we touched briefly on too many times in this series, and that is this business about bad timing. Ending the season with a certain episode, starting the new one with a kind of an odd choice. We went through that when we ended season one, although Lynn liked that episode a lot. Many of us did not. I know Ken and I did not feel it was appropriate to end the season, and now here you're starting season two, and you've got this story. And it makes you wonder why a TV series so famous would have problems in this kind of placement. And when I thought about it, I think one of the reasons is TV at that time, around 1960, was so different than it is now, because now television is all about sweeps weeks and putting your best foot forward at the proper time, and that's all they worry about. They know when they've got good episodes or famous guest stars, so they hold them back and they choose them for certain times, end on a strong note, begin with something big. There's so much more promotion now than there was then. So I think in those days, nobody really cared. I don't think Serling cared or anybody else cared. They had stories. They did them. They did, of course, far more stories than they do on TV today. And it wasn't a big deal. Who really cares how you end the series? If you like the series, you'll come back. And but I think for us now, living when we do, especially for me, it does matter. It really does matter. I mean, if I was the age now that I was then, I would be very put off by ending the first season with a story I didn't like. And now starting it with this, you got to wonder, where's it going? And is it worth my while to keep coming back week after week if this is the direction they're going in? So I have a real problem with that, and that's what I don't like about it. As for the story itself, it's just boring. I just watched it about an hour ago, and every time I watch it, I'm just bored. It's just too repetitious, and I think the story would have been better served. It was more about his survival than about wondering why he's there and what it's all about. He ought to be more worried about that. If I were in his position, I would wonder, so I'm here. I'll worry about how I got here later, but, you know, what about my survival now? And I talked to Lynn a little while ago before the show started, about how this kind of thing reminds me of the movie Castaway with Tom Hanks. And that's one of my favorite films, as it is many people. It was a great success, and it is a very compelling story because it's about his survival. And I always say that in order to really enjoy a story, you have to get involved in it. You have to feel something for the character. You have to feel like, boy, that could be me. And I think in Castaway, that's what's at work. It's about his survival, about not losing your mind when you're alone. He knew why he was there. He knew he was in a plane crash, and that was it. And I think that that makes it a more interesting story. There were also some humorous moments in it. You know, maybe if Robert Cummings had drawn a face on a rock somewhere or something, it would have been a more interesting story. But it's just him wandering around talking to himself. The funny part about it is, as much as I don't like it and I did give it a zero, I think it has possibilities. That's what really annoys me about it. It's really not bad as a story idea, but I'm surprised that Serling couldn't invest more in it than he did. Just for a writer that good and that famous to simply put a story out there in which a man is wandering around, wondering who he is and why he's there, doesn't do a whole lot. And that's the part I really didn't like about it. And also, having watched it about an hour ago, I was amused at the end of the episode when everything is just wrapped up very neatly. I mean, these two guys are sitting there talking to him when he's in the hospital room, and they decide, yeah, it's all in your mind. I mean, it's not quite that easy to just come to an answer like that. It was like the story is only 25 minutes, so they had to wrap it up. And the ending, finding his sand in his shoes there, is interesting, but not enough to have to sit through that long, tedious story. The payoff is not good enough. I don't know that I agree with Ken that I needed any monsters in there or anything like that. I just need, I mean, this, you know, that's a 50-year-old story. And even though that kind of story about a man being stranded in the desert or anywhere is not new, it's an old story, even before the Twilight Zone, the fact is that you can tweak it a little and make it a little more interesting. As for Bob Cummings, though, I didn't particularly like him either back in those days. I think he was a good actor. I remember him from the Bob Cummings Show, which I didn't like. So that's probably one reason why. I think he does a pretty good job for what he's given, which is just wander around like that. But, you know, anytime I'm watching a story and I'm watching the clock too much, then there's a problem with that. I just didn't feel anything for it. And besides that, there's not a lot of mystery here. And that is, what's it all about? Well, it can only be two things. Either it's really happening to him or it's in his mind, one or the other. So it's not like you have to sit there and go, gosh, I wonder what this is. I mean, if you have a brain, you'll probably come up with the ending. Also earlier today, I went to IMDb, the Internet Movie Database, and to see if anybody had done reviews of it. And it gets a 7.2 rating over there out of 10. About 8 people post reviews, and they all pretty much liked it. One called it a classic. One called it the best episode of the series. They thought it was scary and mysterious and frightening.
Somebody called it a classic?
Yeah, one called it a classic. Yeah, he said it was the best episode of the entire series. Wow, don't look at me. It's not my opinion. So I wonder if you've seen the rest of the episodes, but and sir, everybody likes this. So I guess we're out of the loop on this, but no.
It's better than Time Enough at Last. That's pretty bad.
He didn't even mention any other one. He just says this is obviously the best episode of the entire series.
he definitely needs to come on this show.
Definitely.
He or she, whoever.
That's quite true. I should write to him and offer and tell him that we have a show. Anyway, so that's it. I agree with everybody else. I gave it a zero. There's just nothing there. What?
Do you think that it might have worked out better if it was more of a Robinson Crusoe feel to it, if they did
that
ending? Yeah.
Like Tom Hanks in Castaway, yeah. I think everybody can relate to that. That is a scary thought, that you would survive something horrible, but you would find yourself in an even worse position. Now you've got nobody around and virtually no hope of being rescued. And are you going to live, and do you want to live? Is it even worth it? That brings it home. I'm just sitting here watching a guy in the middle of nowhere talking to himself, and I'm wondering where he is. That's all right. So take me to the end of the story and tell me what it's all about. No big payoff, and that's it. I think that is about. I think if they'd done Cast Away that way, with him just wandering for 2 hours, wondering why he was there, I think it would have been a bomb. You've got to involve the audience. You've got to give me somebody to root for and something to really be scared over, and that would do it for me. So it's just, I'm more disturbed, really. The story is not good, but there are plenty of bad stories in the Twilight Zone. I'm more disturbed about the trend. I just don't like this business that it's ending one way and starting a season with this kind of episode is very, very strange. Very strange. You want to get out there right out of the box, and I would have put any one of the season 2 classics right up front so that anybody watching, suppose you hadn't seen it in season 1, you only heard the buzz. And people said, have you seen that new show on TV? Oh, it's fantastic. You turn it on and you go, well, this is what all the excitement is about. So,
and that brings up the question, too, how did they shoot? Did they shoot in order or did they shoot out of order?
That was
just the first one.
I suspect it's out of order, but still you can decide where to place it. You're right, of course. If that's the next script to do, they really had no choice. But my understanding about TV is that it doesn't run that close, that they've got things in the can.
Yes, actually it does, okay? If you're shooting one episode, when you start shooting it, you start writing the next episode. You're done with the one episode, you start the next episode.
On a weekly series?
Yes.
Okay. Wow, I didn't know that.
All right. Okay, that's still no excuse for writing a lousy script, so.
Hey, Bob.
Yeah.
I think the idea they had for the season 2 opener was, let's get a big name from Hollywood to be in our first episode. And they said, hey, Bob Cummings maybe will be the big name.
That's a good point. But you know, that this episode is too much like the episode that opened the series. What are you going to do, open every season with the same kind of episode? It looks too much like that. Even the people at IMDb said, it sure does remind us of the first episode of the series. So,
but look who to bring in for Eye of the Beholder, or even two.
Ah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Can I tell you what people in the industry think about IMDb?
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
Idiot movie database.
Well, I won't argue with that. You won't get an argument from me.
They probably say Wikipedia is closer than IMDb.
Yeah.
Hey, I don't post it IMDb, but I do read it there. It can be amusing sometimes.
You know, if you want to find out if somebody's dead or alive, it's always good to find out.
Yeah, I just go there to find out who's gotten divorced, and I'm always asking Lynn, is that person, is he still alive? And then I go there and find out. So.
About that, guys.
Sorry, I'll say Lynn. You can take it back.
No, I mean going off track.
No, that's okay. That's all right. Hey, Dave, do you have anything to say about it?
Oh, always. Yeah. Yeah, I've got a lot to say about it. First of all, I agree with quite a few comments, but I think it really did have the makings of an excellent episode, but it did fall at the last hurdle. There's no doubt about that. But I take on board that last bit about the fact that, you know, Cummings was taken on as a star actor, but I think he actually was ideal for this part for two or three reasons. First of all, it's hard to believe looking at it, but he was 50 in this role. But of course, when he wakes up in the hospital, the war is 17 years in the past or something. So although when you see it initially, you think, well, he looks a bit old to be a bomber pilot, because they're usually, you know, in the 20s, maybe 30s at the most, because they, you know, it was a not a long-lived profession if you were in that sort of a job. But of course, that worked because it's a going back thing. The fact that Ken said you know, he didn't think he had the right persona, I think he did, because he has that compassion. Bob Cummings does compassion very well, and the whole point was that this journey, as it turned out to be, was his guilt over dogging out of this actual trip. He should have been on that plane when it crashed, and he wasn't. So it was his guilt that was driving that. Also, of course, he was actually the exact person to play this. He actually was a pilot. He was an instructor for some time. Would you believe his godfather was one of the Wright brothers? Orville Wright taught
really?
Him how to fly.
I
yeah.
didn't know that. Oh.
Yeah, well, yeah, his godfather was Orville. He taught him how to fly. He used to take people on flying trips at $5 a time. He's the right age for it in terms of the fact that, as I say, because he was thinking back, the whole thing was going back in time. There were some mistakes, I thought. I mean, I think, like Bobby said, he was a little bit cavalier with the water. I couldn't believe that, you know, when he had this mirage of the one of his co-pilot in the cockpit, you know, he was dropping his water all over the place, and I was sort of saying, save the water, save the water. I was a little bit disturbed about that. And then there was the fact that he said, when the jets came over, he said, how do I know about jets? How do I know about jets? But in actual fact, there were jets. The Messerschmitt was a World War II plane, started flying first. Time it flew was in July 18th, 1942, and this was 1943. So he would have heard of jets as a person in the Second World War. That was a little bit of a mistake on their part, I think. So I thought he was excellent as a choice, because he could carry on that conversation with himself, and I think that's a very difficult thing for an actor to do. And I liked the whole thing. It was a little bit long-winded. But the point was, it does still fail, and I will agree with you all on that, because the payoff at the end was a little bit of a letdown. And boy, oh boy, how much sand did this guy have in his shoe? I mean, he'd have been limping like anything. I mean, they poured about half the Sahara out on that desk. I think that was... So, basically, what I'm trying to say is I thought it was a very brave episode. I think most of the money went on paying his salary and the fact that they you know, they had this... I assume they carted this plane out into the desert, Salt Lake City somewhere. I thought it was also very brave, a few of the other things they did. Rod Sterling was shown in the action on the desert right at the beginning, which I don't think is often done, where he's actually in situ on the set, as it were.
Well, Dave, as Kelly said, that he starts doing that. He starts appearing in the episodes now, yeah.
Yeah, but this is the first time.
Right.
Okay. The other thing was there was a cast of about six other people. They got them all in Second World War gear, and they're on screen for about 5 seconds. I mean, that's going quite a hog to give it some realism. So I thought the setup was really great, but I was expecting a much bigger payoff. The payoff was very limp at the end. It really needed something more of a reveal to have made it anything of a better episode. But I agree with you. I think 90% of the story was excellent, but it just fell at, it just fell at the last fence. So probably I can only give it 2, 2.5. But really, it could easily have been a classic. I think it could have been a classic episode.
Lynn, can I get back in here for a second?
Yeah, sure.
Please forgive me, but while everybody was talking, I went to the hated IMDb and about Bob Cummings. And this year, in June, it was his 100th birthday. He died in 1980. But it says here, just the first paragraph, effective light comedian of 30s and 40s films and 50s and 60s TV series, Robert Cummings was renowned for his eternally youthful looks, which he attributed to a strict vitamin and health food diet. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah,
he
it was 1990 he died, actually. He was 50 here.
Oh, you're right. It's 1990. I read it wrong. Thanks. Yeah, you're right. So this is 100. This would be his 100th birthday, but... yeah, he was known mainly in comedy, really, in that. But as somebody put in the chat room, he was also in Dial M for Murder. And he was very good in that, too, the Hitchcock movie. So.
Excellent.
Well, he's kind of like the Andy Griffith of his time, but Andy Griffith was a lot better, I think, than Bob Cummings was. That's debatable.
As far as the story, I agree with what was just said, that it really isn't a bad idea for a story, and he's good in it. I think he's good in it. But the payoff is nothing. I mean, I just don't like payoff.
Yeah, I mean, John Wayne picked him as his co-star to play as an airline pilot, Captain Sullivan, in The High and the Mighty. So I forgot about that.
You're right, yeah.
Yeah. Hey, Rick, do you have anything to add? Do you have anything to say about this episode?
Nothing to add that hasn't been said already, although I disagree with there might have been a problem with the writing, but I always blame the director when something goes wrong, so I'll blame the director. It's the director's fault. Also... somebody said, they spent tens of thousands of dollars for the set and everything like that. Back then, in today's money, the cost of the series would be, are you all sitting down? I don't think it was more than $2,500 or $3,500.
I believe it.
Yeah, because wages was only about 50 cents, I think, or a dollar or something like that. It wasn't that much.
Probably, yeah.
What was that? And by today's things, it was a low budget show. Back then, it was basically a medium budget, maybe on the low end of the medium thing.
By today's standards. Yeah, by today's standards. Yeah, we consider a low budget, but for them, it was like middle of the road, you know?
Right.
So does anybody else have anything to add here? Anybody else have any last comments?
I wanted to agree with Bob about that movie Castaway. And the reason why that movie was successful was because of Tom Hanks.
Oh, yeah.
He, He just played the part. And yes, you're guessing, and you're kind of along with him on the journey through the movie. What happens next?
Right.
How does he eat?
Actually, I liked his co-star, Wilson.
Oh, was that great? I love that.
Yeah. Wilson should have won an Oscar. He would have given a more interesting speech at the Oscar ceremony than any of the actors do.
I'll tell you, actually felt bad when Wilson, fell off of the makeshift boat. You actually felt bad. You were like, "Come on, get him back."
Yeah. Well, you know what I was thinking, guys, is the Twilight Zone maybe should have. I agree with the point about the Robinson Crusoe aspect. That's a fascinating story. If you've ever seen the old movie, and you just have to wonder along with the guy, what is isolation like, living on that island and going 20 to 30 years without seeing anybody. And so the Twilight Zone could have done something similar to the Robinson Crusoe aspect and make it more scarier. That's how it would have worked for me.
Yeah, that's a possibility, too.
Yeah. Maybe have a beach scene, like in Castaway, the water coming up, the ocean coming up onto the sand, and maybe some pirates or something. But just to be in the desert with his airplane there, it just didn't work for me. I don't know why. It just didn't work.
It was just too long. It dragged. That's all. I just know it dragged on. I just found it to be boring, but... like I said, I'm not a big Bob Cummings fan, so that may have also played into it. I just never really cared for the guy, but, I know a lot that he did a lot of things, and, he received, I think Dave said here, he's saying here he received an Emmy Award for his portrayal of Juror Number 8 in the first televised performance of 12 Angry Men. So the man was not without talent. I personally didn't care for him.
Yeah, but I think I'm not really a big fan of his, but I thought he was actually cast quite well for this because, as I say, the age that he was worked well in the fact that, he'd gone back in time, as it were, to where this plane crash was. And secondly, he seemed to, the way he worked around the aircraft, I thought, he seemed to be a person completely at home with the aircraft, working a radio, sliding in between the different parts of the cockpit, he seemed to be, in his element in that sense. And I think there's not many actors that can talk as though, because he was talking, but he wasn't talking through the fourth wall. He wasn't talking to us. He was keeping up a monologue if you were stranded in the desert, you would probably, to keep your own spirits up, have a monologue with yourself to sort of, keep yourself, on track, keep it together, we'll figure it out. And I thought he did that very well without actually deferring to the audience, doing it. But I do agree with you, Lynn. They did make that a bit protracted and then suddenly tagged a very sort of... twee ending on at the end, which was really it deserved a better ending than that.
Just felt that it was just like, where is everybody, because of the similarities between the first episode of the first season, where he's walking around town, and this one he's walking among the graveyard of these crashed ships, at the end where in the where is everybody, the Air Force colonel, generals, or lieutenants, or whatever, are talking after they pull him out. He's in the bed. The doctors are talking about his condition. Like I said, it also reminded me of a movie called Escape from New York, where they used the script over and did Escape from L.A. And if you see the similarities between both movies, that's the similarities I get with this one.
Well, one more thing I could say, if you don't mind, is that I always think that Rod Sterling uses every idea twice, and I can't remember the name of the episode, but I'm sure there's another one where a pilot flies into an airport and he's from the wrong generation.
The flight one,
And to me, this is the sort of alter ego of that. He seems to, every story he gets, there's two sides to a coin, and he always seems to try and get two stories out of every idea he has.
That's true. That's very true. Okay, well, does anyone have anything else to add to this?
Oh, what's your rating, Rick Wall, out of five?
Yeah. Two.
Okay. All right, that sounds good. And just one other thing. Jay here, Jay Huddle, he is saying that he thought Wilson was the best actor in Castaway, aside from Tom Hanks.
Wilson!
and he thought maybe this should be a success. It was his guest number seven. He says it was a great movie. It was a little bit of a letdown, but he thought maybe there should be a suspenseful kiss between Tom Hanks and Agnes Moorhead. There you go, Ken.
There, Ken. There's your gal.
Okay, well, if nobody else has anything to add here, we will end this discussion today. And I do want to thank everyone who was here.
Lynn, can you send it back to me just for a minute?
Sure.
I just want to remind people, anybody who's in here who has not been to our group, we also have a Yahoo discussion group.
That's right.
In which we're reviewing all the episodes of The Twilight Zone in order. And the name of our group is The Twilight Zone Revisited and Reviewed, all one word with no spaces in between. And thanks to me, the word reviewed is spelled wrong. That's R-E-V-I-W-E-D. That's a Yahoo discussion group, so if you want to go there and join the group, you can review episodes with us as we go along the way.
I just typed in the link.
Okay, good, thanks. Okay. And I also want to tell people that because we're so brilliant here on this show, we've decided to start another talk show program soon. I don't have the exact date yet. It will be called Talking TV Themes. And it's going to be about TV theme music since virtually TV began up until today. It's not only going to be a show to reminisce about what's good and what's bad, but about television theme music and how important it is and whether it can make or break a show. I got the idea for this show because of all the recent buzz over the return of Hawaii Five-0 and the promotion that CBS did with it, in which they were promoting the old music more than they were promoting the show itself. How important is it? Apparently more important than ever. So look for that. The starting date and the information about the show will be promoted during our show here in the next month or so, and also at our Twilight Zone group. So we'd like people to join that. It will be called, like I said, the Talking TV Themes. It is not there yet, but we will let you know when it starts. Okay, Lynn, that's it for me. Back to you.
Okay, and as I said, I put our website back on. I put that on the chat room so that we can see it with the hopefully I typed it in there properly. Robert, if I didn't type that in there properly, if you could correct it, I'd appreciate that.
You got it the right way. It's right.
Okay, excellent.
Episode, Lynn?
The next episode is going to be The Man in the Bottle, and that will be in 2 weeks, and... let me just double check that. I do believe that is the next one. Man in the Bottle, starring Luther Adler, Beatty Janice, and she's this will be her second role in Twilight Zone episode, and Joseph Rossi. So we hope to see everyone in 2 weeks, and I want to thank everyone who was here today, Jay Huddle and guest number seven, and Dave, of course, and Rick Wall, of course, and guest five, guest four, and everyone who was here. And we hope to see you all in 2 weeks. So thanks, everybody, and we'll see you then.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, bye.
Bye.